Paul writes, "Now, this I say, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does corruption inherit incorruption. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. So when this corruptible has put on incorruption, and this mortal has put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O Hades, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labour is not in vain in the Lord." I read that principally for the last two verses. Our victory is in Christ, and therefore we should live for him. And that's basically what we're going to see in John Owen tonight. Now, okay, you've got to press the button now and record. He pressed it. It's already off. Okay. My sign wasn't worthwhile. Okay. It's all right. It's good. It's recording. That's brilliant. Okay. So John Owen, God's man for troubled times. Now, we live in a world and a time which we might consider to be rather troubled, changing times that have taken place. If you think back over the last 100 years, how the world, and particularly our country, has changed through two world wars. We've lost an empire. We've been in Europe. We're about to get out of Europe. We've had numerous changes in our government, in thoughts of morality, in religion, the church, how it's declined in its biblical handling over that century. John Owen lived in a time of more change than anything we could possibly comprehend. So, the 100 years, John Owen was born in 1616. In 1529, King Henry VIII was on the throne, and he separated from the Church of Rome and established the Church of England, principally because he wanted to divorce and get married again so that he could have an heir. 1536, he followed through with the dissolution of the monasteries. Clearly now we've had just one slight of people in the land. Everybody who thought they were Catholic, no longer is allowed to be Catholic, they have to be in Church of England. Okay? But just so as you make sure he's not anti-Catholic, in the same year that the dissolution of the monasteries, William Tyndale is executed in Europe, but principally because King Henry VIII didn't like him and sought to get him executed. He was quite happy to have everyone who he didn't like got rid of. 1547, Edward VI, the son of Henry VIII, becomes king. He is a true Protestant, and he reforms the Anglican Church far more than Henry VIII had in his plans. He moved it away from just being an England Church of England that was the Church of Rome, but he was the head instead, and he really changed it into the Protestant Church. Of course, he was a sickly child. Didn't really get to last very long. And along came Lady Jane Grey. She was a Protestant, but she only lasted, 9 days? And then Queen Mary came along, and she was not Catholic, married to the King of Spain. So now all the people that thought it was okay to be Anglican and Protestant, now they have a Catholic monarch, and we all know bloody Queen Mary, her job is to get rid of all those Protestant people and make them all Catholic again. And she did a pretty good job of killing an awful lot of people who sought to stand for the faith. You can read Fox's Book of Bottles, you see quite a few of them in there. Well, she actually didn't last very long either. 1558, Queen Elizabeth comes onto the throne, who is now a Protestant. She was actually excommunicated from the Church of Rome in 1570. She truly was not liked by the Catholics. She now tries to introduce some sort of balance. She doesn't really want to go around killing all the Catholics. She doesn't really want to have everyone in the land killing each other. So basically she says, you should be a Protestant, but if you're not, then just do it quietly. Yeah, just kind of hide it a bit. But really, we should be Protestant in this land. So there we have all the Catholics kind of hiding it quietly away. But it means that England is now a Protestant country on the northwest border of a Catholic empire. The whole of the rest of Europe is basically Catholic. It's a Germany arc, but basically the rest of Europe is Catholic. And of course that creates certain issues. That's the most famous here, 1588, Spanish Armada. They send their ships up and isn't it fantastic? They lose, we win, we all remember the Spanish Armada. What we don't remember is the English Armada we sent back afterwards to Spain, which lost abysmally. But, you know, we just remember the victories. But it was the war that was ongoing between Europe and England, because we were Protestant, they were Catholic. Well, eventually she dies. Brilliant, apart from the fact she has no heir. They have to try and find someone. They find her cousin, James VI of Scotland, and they make him James I of England. So now we've had not only change of religion, I don't know how many times in the last few years, but now we've got a new king who's from a foreign country. Scotland was foreign. Okay, it will be foreign again soon if they get their independence vote, but it was foreign then. It was not, the Act of Union isn't until 1707. It's a separate country. Okay, so we've now got a foreigner on the throne. Just in case we think things have gone down, 1605, gunpowder plot, try and blow the new king up. Okay, there's no agreement here. The country is in a real lather over whether it should be Catholic, whether it should be Protestant. They're fighting each other. We've got wars going on against Europe. We've got a foreign king ruling here. We've got arguments in the country, arguments out the country. And it's into this that John Owen is born in 1616. He was the son of a vicar, Henry Owen. He was a Puritan vicar at Staden. I think it's called Stadhampton now in Oxfordshire. He had three brothers and a sister. And he was home educated. Hey, okay. Of course, most rich people were home educated then. Okay, so his dad's job was to educate his children. So he educated by his parents until the age of 10, until he had this guy called Edward Sylvester who came in to kind of finish him off. So at 10 he had this guy to come. At the age of 9, Charles I becomes king. This is kind of significant now because Charles believes in the divine right of kings. The king's rule is absolute. He's set there by God, and everyone underneath him, his, their job is to do as they're told. He's married to a French princess, and we all know how well the English get on with the French. Okay? The Scots were fine. The Scots still like the French. But the English doesn't work out so well. Well, he's now married to a Catholic French princess. And the Protestants are not quite so impressed. He tries to, in his throne, and we'll come back to, or in his reign, and we'll come back to this through the talk later on, he tried to impose a uniformity of worship onto the Church of England and the Church of Scotland. Church of England kind of took some of it. The Church of Scotland were not happy in the slightest and revolted against him and had a major hissy fit, as it were, over this prayer book that they had. But he was a man who wants to change the religion again that comes into onto the throne. Well, in 1628, at the grand old age of 12, John Owen goes to Oxford University. Okay, but about you, I don't think I'd have made it at 12. I'm pretty sure my kids, well, two of them have missed it already. They can't make it to Oxford at 12. Clearly, he was a bright child. He studied the average sort of things that you studied at university then. You had rhetoric, you had classical studies, you had grammar, you had philosophy, you had mathematics. He enjoyed his academic study. In fact, he enjoyed his study so much he only used to sleep about 4 hours a day. Okay. He did regret it later on in life. He said it was a bit stupid and it affected his health. Okay, so sleep is a good thing. He wasn't just into doing academics. He enjoyed sport. He liked the long jump. He liked throwing javelins. And he also liked playing the flute. He liked his music as well. So he was an all-round student that excelled throughout these times. He graduated 1632 at 16 with a bachelor's from Oxford. Remember, at this time, you only had two universities, Oxford and Cambridge. They were the only ones that counted. Okay, so he gained his MA in 1635. Which I'm assuming is the same as now, that if you go to Oxford or Cambridge after 3 years, you get given your MA, because they say their bachelor's is so good that after 3 years of living experience, it's as good as every other university's master's. Okay, so when a student from Oxbridge puts NA at the end, they haven't necessarily had to work that much harder for it. They just waited 3 years and got given it. In 1635, he decided that he wanted to go into the ministry, and he was ordained as a deacon and began his seven-year degree study to become a vicar, to get into the ministry of the Church of England. Unfortunately, during this period, this guy, William Lord, here, he became the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he was a man who wanted to go back to a more Catholic view in the Church of England. And so he brought in a set of rules on how the church was to worship, what should happen in there. And he also sought to change Article 17 in the 39 Articles of the Church of England, which we'll come back to again in a minute, because he did not like what was written down of the Church of England. Like I said, he wanted to take it back. Because of this rule, if you didn't follow his way of worship, you were not allowed to be in the church. John Owen did not follow his way of worship, and therefore he had to leave Oxford University. He did not complete his studies. He never, ever finished his studies, even though for the rest of his time he's going to work in the church, he's going to write theology books, he's going to do all these different things. He never actually finished his theology degree. Okay? He had to leave. He left and he became a chaplain. So he'd been ordained as a deacon, so he was allowed to kind of do services. And he became a chaplain at a house of Robert Dormer, and again later on at a guy called Lord Lovelace, and he was basically the tutor as well to the children, so he took on that kind of typical role. A few years later, all this bubbling tension breaks out into outright civil war. The civil war in England actually takes, there are three of them. We always think of it as just one, but there were three civil wars. There was one, the first one, which began in 1642 and ran through till 1645 when Charles I was captured. And then everything was okay and kind of stayed down until 1648 when a revolt blew up again in the southeast of England. And also at this point, the king had managed to persuade the Scots that they were better off with him. And so the Scots rebelled as well. And they started a war, and so from 1648 to 1649, there was the Second Civil War. And in the 1649, at the end of when that war ended, they decided that, you know, we don't really need a king anymore, we'll get rid of him, and we'll come back to that again later. And so his son continued fighting in the Third Civil War, and that lasted from 1649 to 1651. So basically, we were on and off fighting for 9 years. To decide whether or not Parliament or King was sovereign. And then we all know in the end we gave up and went back to the beginning again and had our monarch back. But the Civil War broke out. Now, for John Owen, this had a slight negative side effect. Remember, his job was with Lord Lovelace. Lord Lovelace, clearly, being a lord, was with the King. John Owen, son of a Puritan, was clearly with the Parliament. He therefore lost his job. More than that, he was also related to some very, very rich people in Wales. And he lost his entire inheritance, or any hope of inheritance, because they were all royalists. And he was a parliamentarian. So he stood in the civil war on the side of Parliament, though he wasn't involved in the First Civil War. After leaving his job then, he went to London. And whilst he was there, he decided one day that he wanted to go and hear this man, Edmund Calamy Sr., preach, or the elder, it's got down there, Edmund Calamy the elder, preach in his local church. Now, Edmund Calamy would be, in the future years, one of the people that was in the Westminster Confession. He was one of the guys that went and wrote the Westminster Confession of Faith. And Owen wanted to go and hear him. Unfortunately, and we might have heard this story somewhere before, when he got to the church, he wasn't there, and some random person was preaching at the church. And he was preaching, I've got it down here, he was preaching on, "Why are ye so fearful, O ye of little faith?" Matthew 8:26. Now, at this point in time, Owen was in an unknown state. At best, he had no assurance of his salvation. Or it could be that at this time he is actually converted. That all of the things that he had done before, all of the learning that he knew, all of the taking of the orders of being a deacon in the Church of England, all the standing that he had could well have been without the knowledge of Christ. That he was able to do all of these things without truly knowing forgiveness. There are many people who can go to church, can do amazing things, but not know Christ. Here, he went to this meeting, and it says, hearing this preacher, immediately it arrested the thoughts of Owen as appropriate to his present state of mind, and he breathed an inward prayer that God would be pleased by that minister to speak to his condition. The prayer was heard, for the preacher stated and answered the very doubts that had long perplexed Owen's mind, and by the time the discourse was ended, he succeeded in leading him forth into the sunshine of settled peace. That's clearly a stolen quote, but I can't remember where I stole it from. This man had led Owen either to Christ for the first time or to a true assurance that Christ was all that he needed. And he needed to hear that because in 1642 he is just about to start off on a roller coaster of a life, if it wasn't already enough. I've got to leave a question mark over this man because John Owen never found out who he was. Never, ever knew who he was. This reminded me straight away of Spurgeon. It's just the exact same idea. Turn up for the man you want to hear. Can't get to hear the man you want to hear. God uses another man to speak to what you needed. Well, 1642 began the career of John Owen in writing. This is his first book, A Display of Arminianism. With this, he absolutely nailed his colours to the mast. He wrote it and dedicated it to the Committee of Religion, which was a committee of the Houses of Parliament. Could you imagine that nowadays? In the House of Parliament, the Committee for Religion. And this was a book which he sent to them, and they published it. Okay, they're published by the Houses of Parliament. Why is this all important? Well, I told you about this guy, the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud. By this point, he was in prison. He was arrested in 1640. He wasn't a pleasant man. But he sought to turn over Article 17 of the 39 Articles. Article 17 is of predestination and election. He hated Calvinism. Absolutely hated it, did William Laud. He was the king's man. He stood for the king's own theology. And his first book that John Owen writes is Why Arminianism Is Not True. Okay? He could not have been more in Parliament's camp if he had tried. If things go wrong and the king returns, John Owen is about to be first in line and standing against him. He would continue his writing career through to his death. Be his most famous thing that he left for us. Well, because of this book, he was offered this parish to become the vicar or the pastor in this parish in Fordham. The previous pastor or vicar there had had an unfortunate scandal and at this time was in the Tower of London. So he took up the position where he stayed there, and whilst he was pastor there, he wrote this book, The Duties of Pastors and People Distinguished, and he wrote two catechisms for use by the parishioners. He was a man that knew what it was to be a pastor. He visited, he preached, he sought to train up his people. And that was what these catechisms were for. They were not for him to teach the people. The one was for the adults, and the children's one he wanted the parents to use to teach the children. So that was his use for them, so that everyone could grow and learn from these things. Okay, it's also in this year that the Westminster Assembly began, which would produce the Westminster Confession. 1643, he got married to Mary Rook of a place called Coggleshaw. This is all in Essex, and they had in their marriage 11 children. Unfortunately, 10 died. Only one survived to adulthood. She died of consumption after a failed marriage. didn't have a particularly wonderful time of it in these things. Thankfully, his wife stayed with him for a long time. Well, during this time, in a break in the Civil War, remember the first Civil War went from 1642 to 1645, and the second is 1648 to 1649. During this break, he gets invited to preach to Parliament. Again, what a wonderful idea, we could have it again. People going and preaching to Parliament. Of course, Parliament in 1646 did not meet in our Houses of Parliament, which was a Gothic construction in the 19th century after the old Palace of Westminster burned down in 1834. And so he went into what was then the chamber, which was the old Chapel of St. Stephen's. And he preached to them at the Chapel of St. Stephen's. Now, the Chapel of St. Stephen's is the reason we have our Parliament the way that we have it. It was given to Parliament to hold their assemblies in. And so to make it so that it worked, the first thing they had to do was find somewhere for the speaker to sit. So they got rid of the altar. And they stuck the speaker's chair at the top of the altar steps. It's why they think when MPs come into Parliament, they bow to the speaker's chair. Not because it's the speaker, but because that was where the altar was. And that was their tradition. The MPs would sit on either side of the speaker in exactly the place where the choir would sit. Hence the reason we have our adversarial system. It's because that's where the choir sat, and they just sat in those seats. The system we have of voting, of going through those two doors, comes from the fact that the choir screen had two entrances, one on each side, and they used the choir screen to vote. So they would walk through the thing. And when we rebuilt Parliament in 1834... these elements of the Christian church were just replaced back into our new Parliament construction. So he went and preached to them, and he preached on the Macedonian call from Acts 16 and verse 9. Now, unfortunately, in 1646, the man who was the previous vicar at Fordham died. And that meant that the man who owned all the land could choose who he wanted to be the new vicar. And so he chose someone that wasn't John Owen. But thankfully, Coggleshaw, 5 miles up the road, said, yeah, you can be an R man. Come and be at our church. It's quite handy in the sense that that was where his wife was from. So I'm sure that it worked out well for him moving over there. It was whilst here that he finally fixed his views on church government. He became convinced of what at the time was called congregational church government. Now, we've got an idea of congregational church government means that the congregation rules in the church. Okay, so what did they mean then? The independent or congregational view just meant that the churches were not ruled over by a higher authority, as in a presbytery or a bishop or an archbishop or whatever else. We have an independency of the church. Owen himself believed in elder oversight of the church and eldership rule. And also, he was a Peter Baptist, so he still had child and infant baptism. But that was where he developed those views, and he stuck with them through thick and thin until his death. Well, in 1648, we had the uprising and the outbreak of the Second Civil War. And in the southeast, the man who was in charge of all the army of the parliamentarians, Lord Fairfax, was sent down to put down the rebellion in the southeast. He met the royalists in battle. Unfortunately, wasn't quick enough to stop from getting back into Colchester, and they all, after he defeated them in battle, they legged it back into the city, closed the gates, and he had to form a siege. He surrounded Colchester and laid siege to the city. I have to say it didn't go well for the people inside, because they refused to surrender until they carried on waiting and expecting that there would be reinforcements that would come. And they were waiting for these reinforcements to come down from Scotland. And in 1649, when the Scottish finally decided to come down, they were defeated by the second in command of the army, who was Oliver Cromwell, in Preston. It was only in 1649 they decided that they'd give up. Even then, they weren't necessarily well treated. But basically, they'd run out of food, they'd run out of everything in this year that they locked themselves in. Whilst he was besieging the city, he surrounded the whole city, and he set up his main camp in a small village of Coggleshall, where he happened to find a Puritan vicar, John Owen, in there, and he took him on board as a friend, and he took him on board as the chaplain of the army, and so Owen would, well, he became his friend. He knew Oliver Cromwell's son-in-law. Indeed, he preached at Oliver Cromwell's son-in-law's funeral in 1651, And being the chaplain to the war, or to the army at this time, he would go around to the soldiers and he'd preach to them about the evils of religious persecution. He hated religious persecution of all sorts, whether you were Catholic, Anglican, whether you were independent, whether you were Presbyterian, it didn't matter. He hated all of that, and he preached against it to the soldiers. I don't think they listened particularly well. There was a bit of a slaughter at the end of the time. In 1649, we became a republic. It was decided after the Second Civil War, we couldn't actually have this guy lying around. He needed to be got rid of. The king was a figurehead. And so he was tried for treason and levying war on the nation, was found guilty, and he was beheaded on Tuesday the 30th of January. And of course, I'm sure we all know that he asked on the morning that he was to be beheaded, he asked for 2 shirts. It was a bit chilly in January, you might have noticed. And he said, I need 2 shirts because otherwise they might mistake my shivering in the cold for shivering in fear. And he went out and had his head decapitated. On Wednesday the 31st, John Owen went and preached before Parliament on the righteous zeal encouraged by divine protection. And having gave a whole sermon on that, he didn't mention the events of the day before. Just kind of blindly passed over them all, as you would do. Lord Fairfax declined to sign the death warrant for Charles I. He didn't believe that it was the right thing to do. Now, that kind of meant that he could not continue to be the leader of Parliament. And so Lord Fairfax stopped being the head of the parliamentarian faction, and the head of Parliament. And instead, his second in command took control, and that was Oliver Cromwell. Straight after the death of Charles I, Charles II continued the war, continued to fight it. He would fight on for another 2 years. And to make sure that we could put it down, Oliver Cromwell decided that he would go and put down all these wars. One day after preaching again in Parliament in April, he went to the home of Lord Fairfax, and whilst he was there, Oliver Cromwell burst into the room and said, Sir, you are the person I must be acquainted with. Owen humbly replied, That will be much more to my advantage than yours. And Cromwell returned, We shall soon see that. Well, Cromwell was about to take him all over the country and use John Owen in whatever way he saw fit. He made him chaplain of the army and took him over to Ireland. We know this is not necessarily Cromwell's greatest time. There are an awful lot of people and troubles that still exist because of this particular campaign. He certainly killed a lot of people, but then we have to remember that the rebellion in Ireland had already killed an awful lot of Protestants at the time. I don't think anyone can say that there was no fault to share around. While he was in Ireland, he was chaplain to the army, and also he oversaw the improvement of Trinity College in Dublin. He told the government what needed to be changed there to improve what was going on. And finally, in 1650, he returned back to Coggeshall. Didn't get to stay very long, though, because Cromwell came back and went up to Scotland to try and beat the Scots, because that's where Charles II was, and says, you're going to come with me. So he dragged him back out from Coggeshall, took him up to Scotland, and made him go up the army there to continue in that role. He got to preach whilst he was there in John Knox's church at St Giles in Edinburgh, where he was commended by the church leaders there. So even though he was effectively an invading army, because Scotland was on the king's side, still he found that they recognised him and the skills that he had and the Christianity that was within him in that place. Before Cromwell had finished in 1651, because he's about to chase Charles II all the way down to Worcester, he returned home to Coggeshall. And he was there only for a short while. And I don't know about you and how you would feel about this, but when he was at home, he had a newspaper delivered, and he read in the newspaper that he had just been appointed to be Dean of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford. Personally, I like to apply for jobs when I get one. He read about this job that he'd been given in the paper by Oliver Cromwell, so he had to leave. And he couldn't stay in Coggeshall, he had to move to Oxford. So he became the Dean of Christ Church College in Oxford. In September of 1851, so that was in March of 1651 he went there. In September of 1651, he preached a Thanksgiving sermon before Parliament again. He's in Parliament quite a lot. He's now listed with the highest in the land. And in 1652, he is made Vice Chancellor of Oxford University and is given the title of Doctor of Divinity. Okay. Now, the actual Chancellor of Oxford University at this time was a man called Oliver Cromwell. Okay, so he kind of decided that he was going to just raise him up, make him his Vice Chancellor. And whilst he was Vice Chancellor, he set about trying to fix all the problems at Oxford that had occurred through the Civil Wars. He was a man that didn't necessarily believe that you should force change in conscience, but he was also a man who was prepared to use virtually any tactic to get it through with the way that he wanted, so that he would have meetings, and then at the end, he would have told his friends that he was going to have a short little one at the end, so don't rush off too quickly, and everyone else would get up to leave, and his friends would kind of hang about a bit, and as they got out the door, then he said, oh, just one more point to add to the meeting. Let's vote on this and sort of get it through. So he was happy to use rather underhand means, but he wouldn't force it on people. Okay, he was a Puritan. And we often have an interesting view of Puritans. In fact, I think this black and white picture is probably the best way we can have it. The Puritan has a very mean look on his face. He's dressed in dark colours. He's most drab, and everyone, of course, hates the Puritan because he doesn't like fun and he doesn't like enjoyment and everything of those things. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite fit with exactly what the Puritan life was like. Puritans believed that the Bible should inform everything that we do. That meant that some of the things that people say, like, well, Puritans didn't like anything, they banned Christmas. Well, they did. Because they thought that Christmas and the celebration of Christmas was a Romish ceremony and would lead people back to Rome. They didn't object to having feasts, they objected to going back to Rome, and they said this wasn't part of it. However, they drank beer in vast quantities, not so they got drunk, but because water was an extremely dangerous thing to drink, and they encouraged the brewing of beer within things. They agreed in sexual union within marriage, and indeed, if it was not given within marriage, as is required in Corinthians, it was a grounds for divorce. Okay. Indeed, the Puritans in New England were some of the most advanced people in the world at the time. Their education system required that all children were taught how to read and write by their fathers, far in advance of the UK, where compulsory schooling doesn't come in until the 19th century. So nearly 300 years, or certainly 200 years before England gets it, New England, the Puritans had it over there. In fact, just to put this in context, John Owen was attacked whilst being the VC of Oxford. This is a man who really didn't like John Owen. He said, instead of being a grave example to the university, scorned all formality, undervalued his office by going in quirpo like a young scholar, with powdered hair, snake bone band strings, or band strings with very large tassels, lawn band, a large set of ribbons pointed at his knees, and Spanish leather boots with large lawn tops, and his hat mostly cocked. Doesn't sound like a Puritan, does it? It's not our view of Puritan, but that was what they said of John Owen, and he was an archetypical Puritan. Well, in 1657, there was a question mark over what should happen. Should we really stay a republic, or should we become a monarchy again? And should Oliver Cromwell become the king? Oliver Cromwell quite liked the idea at the end, actually. He was going to move that way. John Owen wasn't so sure, and he told Oliver Cromwell that he didn't think he should become king. Okay? That he should remain as a true republic, that England should remain as a true republic. For his stance against the king, he lost his position as Vice-Chancellor of Oxford, and instead, Oliver, the Chancellor of Oxford, set his son, Richard Cromwell, to be the Vice-Chancellor of Oxford, the ultimate in nepotism. In 1658, Oliver Cromwell died, and his son took over. He was a rather weak and rubbish leader, and so in 1660, Charles II was restored to the throne. In 1658. So now we've got a short gap. He's no longer the VC at Oxford, but we still have a Puritan-led government and Church of England. And so he got together with Thomas Goodwin and four other people, and they went to the Palace of Savoy, and they wrote the Savoy Declaration, which is the declaration of the independent churches, to say basically where they didn't agree with the Westminster Confession of Faith. And to do this, they did it quite straightforwardly. They got the Westminster Confession of Faith. They said, I like 90% of it. They copied it. And they went, but this is how we think church government should happen. And they drew up that confession. However, it says at this time, the differences between Presbyterians and independents are differences between fellow servants. And churches consisting of persons sound in faith and of good conversation ought not to refuse communion with each other, though they walk not in all things according to the same rules of church order. Even in his declaration of producing this Savoy Declaration, he does not want to create division between the Westminster Confession and himself, between the Presbyterians and the independents within the Church of England. He believes that you should be able to, as long as you are a believer, as long as you have the fundamentals right, be able to walk together, even in disagreements. Well, clearly 1660, the King Charles II comes back, and King Charles II is not an independence man. He is going to remove that. The Presbyterians are now in power. They remove him from Oxford, Christ Church in Oxford. And he goes back to his birthplace in Staddon in Oxfordshire, and here he pastors a small congregational independent church. And he now begins to champion the independent cause, writing numerous books. And he also, not just writing books of theology, he wrote books explaining about how the nonconformists were being so badly treated from this period forwards. And it's from 1660, kind of onwards, that the real trouble for the independent church begins. 1662 is the real start in that sense, when a nonconformist dark cloud comes over the whole land, as it were. In 1662, the Act of Uniformity required all people to sign up to the Common Book of Prayer, the New Book of Common Prayer. About 2,500 Church of England ministers could not sign up to that book. And on August the 24th, 1662, St. Bartholomew's Day, the Great Ejection took place, throwing out all those ministers from their livelihoods. The actual act itself was one of four, which is known by the Clarendon Code. It was brought by a man called Lord Clarendon, the Lord Chancellor, and he sought to bring uniformity to the Church of England. And in 1661, he brought in the Corporation Act, which said, if you want to hold office, civil, military, anything at all, you have to be a member of the Church of England. And that's kind of all right. Most people are members of the Church of England. This basically rules out Catholics. But in 1662, with the Act of Uniformity, all nonconformists, all those who were sort of part of the Anglican Church, are thrown out. And so this 1661 now means anyone who's a nonconformist cannot be a civil servant, cannot be in the army, cannot work for government, cannot do a whole host of jobs. All those ministers have just lost their living. 1664, with the Conventicle Act, means you cannot have more than five households represented in a meeting. This would be illegal. From 1664. 1665, with the 5 Mile Act, you weren't allowed within 5 miles of a city. You weren't allowed anywhere near your previous parish. So those people who had lost their jobs in 1662 now had no means of support from their parishioners because they weren't allowed in their parish. They had to move away. Neither could they go within 5 miles of a city or town. Now this is real persecution for the church. This is taking place throughout the land. As I said, it meant they couldn't hold office in military or civil, neither could they gain a degree from Oxford or Cambridge. They lost all of those things. Now, John Owen himself had an easier time than most, because he had rich and powerful friends, and he wasn't poor himself. That being said, He was still harassed and arrested during this period, and his church congregation was dispersed because you couldn't have more than five families represented at any meeting. Well, in 1661, a Franciscan friar called John Vincent Cain decided to take advantage of all of these troubles in the UK, and he wrote a book called Fiat Lux, Let There Be Light, in which he revealed the glorious truths of Rome and how everyone should return to the purity of Rome and how everything is marvellous. His desire was to bring the country back under the Pope. Well, this man here, the Lord Chancellor, Lord Clarendon, the man who is bringing in all of these codes against nonconformists, is tasked with finding someone who could possibly write a response to this Catholic friar's book. After seeking through all the land, who could he possibly find to write it but the nonconformist John Owen? He comes to John Owen and says, oh, could you write me a book that really, you know, that goes against this and shows where he's wrong? And John Owen writes a complete and utter response to this book. Now, my pronunciation of this will be completely wrong. Ad manid versions of the Fiat Lux. Yeah, that was his response. And it basically, in a reasoned and restrained manner, goes through and explains every fault and flaw with the book that had been published. I mean, in this book, the Fiat Lux, John Vincent Cain claims that the Roman Catholic Church has only ever had one view, and that view has always stayed the same and was always right. Which is an interesting view to take on the Catholic Church, and John Owen pointed out that particular error. Lord Clarendon was impressed by this book, so much so that he offered the nonconformist independent John Owen whether he would like to become a bishop in the Church of England. Owen's response was that he said he would if there was liberty in the church for all who agree with the Church of England in doctrine, but not in practice. Freedom of practice, but agreed with the church in doctrine. Now, as we've seen, the Clarendon Code, those four rules, were about getting the whole church to agree in practice as well as worship. So he didn't accept, and so he went no further. But it's interesting that he could have become a bishop. Well, during this time, he was invited in 1663 to go to Boston, to New England, to join all the Puritans there and become Baptist, become the pastor of the first Congregational Church in Boston. He declined. In 1671, he was asked again to cross the Atlantic, this time to become the president of something called Harvard. So he could have been the president of Harvard there. He again declined. And throughout this period, he was invited to a number of universities in Holland, where, again, he could have escaped this persecution with ease. Could have just travelled away and had a much, much easier life. Well, finally, 1672, King Charles II, he issued something called the Declaration of Indulgence, which allowed nonconformist congregations to be larger than they were before. So you could have more than just the five families represented there. And John Owen drew up an address to give thanks to the king so that we could have these meetings that we can enjoy now. Charles's motives, however, weren't necessarily to help the congregational churches. He actually had a desire to try and help the Catholic churches so that they could meet together in larger numbers. And Parliament weren't particularly impressed by this, and they made Charles revoke the declaration and reintroduce what was called the Test Act of 1673, which again required everyone who was to take public office to take Anglican communion, or to basically swear an oath to, I guess in our contemporary terms, British values. Clearly, this bit went through. However, there was an opportunity for meetings to take place, and a Presbyterian congregational nonconformists that could get together in London. They would meet together, and he spoke regularly in these places. These churches that took place in London were filled with people from all levels of society, from the lowest right up to the highest ranks, from the old parliamentarian army. They were all there. Listening, and Owen would preach there quite regularly, and he was held in high esteem by all. In 1674, he was invited to go to meet with the King, King Charles II, and his brother, the future King James II, And they both assured him of their good intentions towards nonconformists. And they said that they were worried by the persecution and the troubles that they had had. And to show how worried they were, they gave them 1,000 guineas to John Owen to spend on helping the nonconformist ministers and the poor that were in, that he knew of and the troubles that they had had. In 1676, Mary Rook died. They'd been married for 33 years. I think it was a thing back then. He waited for 18 months and then he married the wealthy widow of Thomas Doyley, a woman called Michelle. So 18 months later, he was now married again. But and there's been another sad moment for him. Well, this is probably the most famous Puritan who suffered in this country. John Bunyan. He was sent to prison in 1660 and was released in 1672 because he refused to stop preaching. He could have left at any moment. He could have let him go if he just refused, if he just stopped preaching. His family were reliant on the help of the church and what money he could earn from prison in making shoelaces. Says when Bunyan preached, Owen was among the thousands who hung on his every word, and the king was reported to have asked Owen how he could endure to hear a tinker prate. Owen's response, famously, "May it please your majesty, could I possess the tinker's ability for preaching, I would willingly relinquish all my learning to be able to do those things." Well, toward the end, the latter end of his 12 years imprisonment, confined to Bedford Jail, Owen is supposed to have intervened repeatedly to get him out. Supposed to have worked on his behalf. And during his time in prison, he wrote, this is by far the most famous book he wrote. I believe it's the second most published book or bought book in the world, Pilgrim's Progress. However, he'd been in prison for a long time. He was a poor man. He didn't have any money to get it published. How did he get it published? John Owen paid for it to get published, using his own publisher. So that was published by John Owen's publisher using his own money because he thought it was that important to get it published. Well, from 1674 to his own death in 1683, John Owen focused from that period on writing. And his final work was called The Meditations and Discourses on the Glory of Christ. If you get it now, it's just called The Glory of Christ. That book was, in effect, a man who is at the gate of heaven, looking forward to his Saviour, longing to see him face to face. It says, the day before his death, he wrote to a friend, "Although I am not able to write one word myself, yet I am very desirous to speak one word more to you in this world, and do it by the hand of my wife. I am going to him whom my soul has loved, or rather who has loved me with an everlasting love, which is the whole ground of my consolation. The passage is very irksome and wearisome, through strong pains of various sorts which are all issued in an intermitting fever. I am leaving the ship of the church in a storm, but whilst the great pilot is in it, the loss of a poor under rower will be inconsiderable. Live and pray and hope, and wait patiently, and do not despond. The promise stands invincible that he will never leave us nor forsake us." On the 24th of August, 1683, the anniversary of the great ejection of 1662, John Owen passed into glory. And he was buried in Bunhill Fields, which is also given the title of Puritan Necropolis. Same place that Thomas Goodwin, who had written the Savoy Declaration with him, was buried in 1680. And John Bunyan would be buried in 1688. And if you go and look at the list, there's an awful lot of good men that were buried there. But what do we get from John Owen's life? What was the legacy to us of John Owen? Well, the most obvious one are his books. He only wrote 85 published works during his life. I don't know how many books you've written. I can claim one book. No one else has written it, apart from the people who had to for my PhD viva. 85 different books. All of them are available. Every single one you can still get and read. He is regarded as the greatest English theologian of all time, and his sole aim was to show Christ in everything that he sought to do. Okay, like I said, they're all updated. This is great. This is the works of John Owen. However, it's not the complete works of John Owen. There are some missing, so you have to get a separate set of books to get the bits that aren't in there. But they are all available. He also spent his life seeking to have freedom of religion, seeking to have stop the persecution that was ongoing all around him. He never got to see it. He died in 1683. 6 years later, in 1689, the Act of Toleration was passed. 1689, for this church, is vitally important. This is the 1689 Baptist Confession, gets published because of the Act of Toleration, so that we can have the church founded here on what we are based upon. His work was to drive that through, so that when the Act of Toleration is allowed, and we have this opportunity, then the 18th century revivals are not hindered in the same way. Without the Act of Toleration, we can't have a Methodist movement. We don't have Baptist churches. We can't have Congregational churches. We cannot have a Presbyterian church in the UK. He sought for that. He worked for that. He strove for that. Because of people like John Owen, we have the freedoms that we enjoy now. And we should never take them for granted. It is something that I think we should look more and more at now in our country. As I said, that requirement that was placed on people to sign an oath to make sure that they were in the Church of England community and communion. Well, what happens when we are forced to sign up to the British values? Can biblical Christians really sign up to something like that? What is it when the church is going to have its Sunday schools investigated by Ofsted and by the government to decide whether what you are teaching in your Sunday school to your children is in line with British values? If it's not a return back to the Clarendon Code, to pre-1689, we will, even in our lifetimes, see these troubles. We need to have men like John Owen who will stand. Men who don't care about riches, who have been at the highest point, VC of Oxford University. He was a member of Parliament whilst he was there. He knew kings, and he didn't care. He knew poverty. All he cared about was standing for Christ. That's what we need, and that's what we will need in this country if it continues on the path that we're going down. May God raise up men like him for us. Well, I hope it was of some value, of some use. He is a great man. If you wish to know far more, there are an awful lot of people who can tell you all about his theology and his books and everything else. This was merely an overview, really, to see how he fitted in and the times that he lived in and how we need to seek those same things. Well, we'll pray. We'll seek God's blessing on this, and then hopefully we can go through and enjoy a warmer time of fellowship where we'll turn all the heating on in the other room. Dear Lord God, our loving and gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are a God who, as John Owen said, will not leave us alone. You will not leave the ship to be, you will not forsake us, you will not leave us alone. Lord, help us to trust you. Help us to trust you even in these days that we live, that you rule over our country. That, Lord, that we would be able to stand fast even in persecution. That we would hold these same things dear to us that he held in his life. That Christ is all. And that, Lord, if we have him, nothing on this world is worthy of exchange. Lord, I pray that we would make sure that we have Christ. And that having him, we would live for him and seek to honour him in all that we do, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.